those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
This is Herb. This is Community Spotlight. Each week I try and bring in a member of the community, an organisation, or talk about an event. And this morning I have Steve Debus. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Herb. Thanks for having me.
No, it's great that you were able to come in. Had a cancellation on another project you were doing, so that's fortunate for us. So tell me, Steve, and we're going to get into your research on birds and raptors, but first of all, where were you born?
I was born in Sydney, spent the first couple of years or so till preschool there, and then moved to a small country town by the start of primary school.
So that was in the Riverina?
That's correct, yeah. I was primary school in the Riverina.
And then went to uni in Macquarie Uni?
That's correct, yeah. High school and undergrad in Sydney.
And prior, you probably did Bachelor of Science?
That's correct, yeah.
And then you came to Armidale in 79?
Yes.
To do a DipNat Res?
That's correct, yes.
Diploma of Natural Resources?
Yes, at UNE, yep.
You then went and did a master's on owls at UNE.
Yes.
So let's go back a step. What point in your life did you know that birds was going to be your future?
Oh, it was in primary school. It was the contrast in the diversity of birds and the fact that people knew their names, a lot of the country people knew the names of a lot of the common birds. And, yeah, the contrast between suburban Sydney and the country was pretty strong. And in those days, in the 60s, you would see wedge-tailed eagles shot and hung on fences, which was fairly graphic for a year five boy, I suppose. Hadn't seen that sort of thing before.
And I think, yes, they do say that a child, so 11 and 12-year-old, that's when they start to really decide where they want to go with their life. Now, you talk about the wedge-tailed eagle hanging on the fence. Now, they were shot and killed because people were in fear that they were killing lambs and doing a whole lot of damage to their stock and different things. And they were poisoned, and it was a horrible time for the wedge-tailed eagle.
Yes.
And also for people who loved the birds as well, flying in the sky. But tell me, where does the wedge-tailed eagle fit in the ecosystem, or our Australian ecosystem?
Well, in land ecosystems, it's kind of the top of the food chain. There's only, well, there would have been one other carnivore that's probably bigger and more powerful, would have been the dingo, until, you know, we introduced other animals. At the top of the food chain, that they're sort of regulating prey populations, and they're a good indicator species too of the health of the environment. And they eat agricultural pests as well, like rabbits and hares and young kangaroos and that sort of thing. So, yeah, they're important in the ecosystem.
Well, thankfully now they're protected under the New South Wales Wildlife Act. They can't be harmed. And have we seen, since those 60s and those times of poisonings and trappings and shooting of wedge-tailed eagle, have we seen a resurgence in the populations?
Yeah, well, I think so. I think the feeling is that it didn't really make a lot of difference in those days. They were probably much shyer of people in those days, but now there's good numbers of them, and they're more willing to nest within 200 or 300 metres of houses and so on out in the countryside. So they're certainly more visible and more approachable than they used to be.
They're a big nest, huge nests, an apartment block almost of sticks. And do they go back to the same nest each year?
They do. They sometimes have alternative nests, but they generally stick with one nest as long as it's serviceable. But occasionally the weight will get too big and the limb will fall off of the tree or something. So they can build another nest, and they can have alternative nests also for any reason they need to shift.
Now, is it true that they have long, lifelong partners, or is that just an urban myth or a rural myth?
I think it's an interpretation of what mating for life means. It means, in the case of eagles and so on, it's for the life of either partner. So if something happens to one, the survivor will get a new mate. But they stick together while they're both alive.
And also there's the story of them mating in mid-flight. Have you seen that?
I've seen what could be interpreted as that, but it's a bit of a myth. What it is part of the display behaviour, the courtship behaviour, where the male will dive at the female and she'll roll over and put her feet up, and they sometimes touch feet and complete, the female will then complete the barrel roll. It's part of their courtship manoeuvres, but they mate on a branch near the nest.
So in that mating ritual, there's no colloquial kiss?
No. As far as I'm aware, swifts are the only birds that have been confirmed to do that.
And how many eggs?
Wedgetails, normally one or two each year when they lay. Sometimes they miss a year if the food's not good or a drought or something.
So what other birds, we see similar birds in other continents. So are we talking about bald eagles, like the similarity?
Oh, the bald eagle is a fish eagle or a sea eagle, so it's more like our white-bellied sea eagle. But wedgetails, the equivalent on other continents would be the golden eagle, probably the imperial eagle in parts of Europe, and certainly the African eagle, or Verreaux's eagle as it's called. It's actually closely related to the wedgetail, and there's an even closer relative in New Guinea, Gurney's eagle. So that, yeah, those big eagles are well represented on most continents.
Yeah, they're surprisingly large. You don't really get an idea when they're flying high up in the sky how big they are until you see them close up, maybe on the side of the road or so. Yeah. You did, in about 1980, do a master's on owls.
Yeah, that's correct. That followed a bit of work for Hugh Ford, who was researching birds. I started off as a research assistant for him and his postgrad students, and then he and Harry Recker got a grant to look at the impact of logging of old-growth forests on the large forest owls in the northeast forests in the early 90s. So, yeah, that became both a job and a master's degree on looking at owls.
So what owls are we talking about?
Talking about powerful owls, sooty owls, masked owls and barking owls, although I didn't find many barking owls in the tall forests. But I did record all the nocturnal birds and some nocturnal tree-dwelling mammals as well, because they're part of the food chain for the large owls.
So you talked about recording, but is that recording and callback or just recording?
I was using owl call playback to detect them, because they respond to the broadcast of calls. And then in those days, of course, it was all written notes and so on. I would have a data sheet and record in writing what I detected, and whether it was before or after the call playback, because there'd be a listening phase and then there'd be the call broadcast and then there'd be listening and spotlighting for any responses. So, yeah, that was the method.
And so was that method something new to the survey of owls?
Well, certainly in Australia, there was a couple of other people started doing the same thing about the same time and for the same species, particularly sooty owls. Yeah, so it was early days of that method in Australia, although I think people had been using the method overseas, probably in Britain and Europe and North America before that, and we would have sort of adapted the method for our owls.
So did you actually see any impact of the logging of the forest to owl populations?
Well, I was studying presence and absence in forest that was either logged or unlogged. It seemed like the masked owl was surprisingly the one that was most affected, probably because it requires a high density of hollow trees, and a lot of its prey would be using hollow trees or cavities, and it liked the drier forests where hollows are probably fairly scarce. And but powerful owls, although they need the large hollow trees, they're able to feed on prey that can live in regrowth forests as well, like ringtail possums. And sooty owls too take a lot of ground prey, and they seem to be okay in the forest refuges in the sort of rugged country that was not logged. From memory, the modelling that was done, I contributed my data to the National Parks database. As far as I can remember, the masked owl was the one that came out and most likely to be absent from heavily logged areas.
And I suppose the regrowth to occur over a number of years to then get to a structure where the owl population would build up again.
Yeah, well, that's right. And again, dense regrowth is doesn't favour masked owls, because they need open spaces on the ground where a mosaic of open and dense ground cover to catch their prey, whereas the sooty owls and powerful owls could catch animals in regrowth forest in the tree canopy. So that might be part of the reason why there was that difference.
In combination with that, then you went and did a PhD, was it on woodland birds?
That's correct, yeah. I was looking at the declining woodland birds and trying to investigate some possible reasons why they might be declining. I was particularly focused on the robins, yellow robins and scarlet robins, and I've spent some time on hooded robins as well.
So can we just go through quickly a list of our woodland birds that people might see?
Well, if I start with the sort of parrots and so on, turquoise parrots and swift parrots, little lorikeets are all listed as threatened woodland birds. And then we move through, well, there's the owls and birds of prey. There's barking owl and boobooks and so on. And some of the woodland specialist birds of prey would be square-tailed kite and little eagle and a few others. And Then we get to all the songbirds. There's a lot of threatened woodland songbirds, from tree creepers and various honey eaters and sitellas and wood swallows and so on, and diamond firetail, which is a finch. There were several honey eaters, a painted honey eater, black-chinned regent honey eater, tree creepers as well. Oh, the brown tree creeper is threatened. We have one or two other species as well.
So can we say that there's a link between the diversity and potentially abundance of the woodland species to the quality of the woodland?
Yeah, absolutely. The woodland birds that are most threatened are the ones that require special components of the woodland, like native tussock grasses, a lot of litter and logs and things on the ground, the sort of crevices and cavities you get in mature woodland and hollows. Yeah, that sort of thing. Profuse blossom in mature trees. Yeah, that sort of thing.
So I suppose it sort of then points to, if you've got good structure in a woodland, you've got a ground habitat, decomposing timber, you've got bush ground cover, you've got bush cover, you've got tree cover, then that serves each one of the woodland species, or the bird species, because they require different parts of the habitat to populate. Some might get their food from the decomposed stuff on the ground, as you said, some of the saps from the trees. So I suppose that's what we're pointing to, is that a good diverse habitat will give a good diverse population of woodland birds.
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't specifically mention the shrub layer, but that's important. And also mistletoes, they've been demonstrated to contribute to the richness of the ground layer. The nutrients in mistletoe supports more birds than would be the case if there wasn't mistletoe, which is a native. There are many species of native mistletoe, and they're an important component of the woodland structure as well.
So I think you just mentioned richness. I love that word, richness. Mm. So if you have a rich habitat in a woodland ecosystem, you have a rich diversity of woodland birds, and I suppose that's what those who are trying to repopulate or regrow New England need to think about, those different parts of the ecosystem when we're planting. And I know the Armidale Tree Group are very helpful if anybody wants to go and try and recreate habitat. That's where you get your plants. They do a great job down there.
The valuable focus is on the locally indigenous flora as well, which is what the locally occurring woodland birds are adapted to.
Yes, that was your PhD on woodland birds, and since that time you've been basically working out of UNE?
As an honorary research associate, I'm not employed there, but I'm an advisor or co-supervisor of postgrad students doing projects on birds of prey.
That's why you're here, because you had to cancel one of the PhD students who was putting cameras up on a little eagle's nest, I think Mick Wakefield, a PhD student.
That's correct, yeah. Mick is studying little eagles in a lot more depth than I can for the local land services project. So he has had, for the last year or so, had acoustic recorders on nest trees, and also we've attempted to put nest cameras up. We got one camera up last year, and now this year that camera has fortunately survived the snow, but it still needs to be serviced. But, well, it'd be Mick and an arborist is engaging to put the cameras up on a few more nests if the nests have survived. It's a question of how many of our nests have survived the snow.
Well, I suppose we'll just have to wait and see. Now, I mentioned around cameras. Now, drones. Now, I know drones weren't very effective for around birds of prey because they'd attack the drones.
Correct, yeah. Wedge-tailed eagles are notorious for knocking very expensive drones out of the sky that are used in sort of geological surveys and that sort of thing. And one of I say, my little eagles, when they were surveying the new Armidale landfill site out on the Gera there, yeah, that male little eagle was swooping the drone. It didn't make contact as far as I know, but yeah, that pair of little eagles is gone now because the disturbance and so on was too much for them, clearing and the active landfill, and all the great flocks of crows and ravens that are aggressive and exclude little eagles from areas. Those eagles have gone, but the male, while he was there, was swooping the drone.
So do the little eagles have their own sort of patch and territory? Now, you mentioned that that pair might have moved off. Would they move off and find another patch, or would they have to fight for territory from another pair of eagles? How does that work?
It depends how much woodland cover is around. If there's enough woodland cover within the sort of general home range area of a pair, they can build an alternative nest. And I've had a few pairs over the years that I've been following them, I've had a few pairs shift their nest site into other areas of woodland, if, you know, up to a few hundred metres or so away. But they do maintain and defend territories against other pairs. So we, around here, we generally get about somewhere between 2 kilometres and 5 kilometres between neighbouring pairs, depending on how continuous the woodland cover is. So in areas of good woodland, you know, they'll be down to maybe two kilometres apart. But yeah, they do defend against other little eagles and wedgetails. They hate wedgetails.
So you did mention the LLS Raptor Project. That's Local Land Services, yes. Raptor Project. Now, it's been going on since 2017, and it's focused on the three threatened species. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Of raptors?
Yeah, the three main target species are the little eagle and the square-tailed kite and the white-bellied sea eagle. By its name, we have a few pairs nesting on big water bodies on the tablelands and even further west.
So do we have, so we're 2017, so we're getting close to 10 years, I suppose, getting close, a couple of years out. Do we have any results, early results of what we might have seen in 2017? Now, considering 17 was a fairly dry period and we've moved into a bit wetter.
Well, for say little eagles, because we keep searching each year, we're up to, I think, nest number 46 of little eagles across the whole tablelands. Our survey area, sort of, I'm talking about from near Walker up to Tenterfield and west, you know, to Bundara, Kingstown, Bundara, and that sort of thing, east to a bit east of Gyra near Malpas Dam. So, but that's not the current total. We've lost a few pairs around Armidale with urban expansion and so on over the years. There's a few pairs have been displaced, and I can't monitor all 46 every year, and there's a few volunteers that do monitor some pairs, but overall their breeding success, it went down during the drought and then has recovered, so that around about 75% of the pairs that I'm able to monitor, that's usually around about 20 pairs a year, do manage to get a young one off. With little eagles, it's usually one young one. Very occasionally they get two. With the kites, far fewer pairs now, and I think all told I've only been able to find about four pairs of the kites during the project, although I did know of a couple of others before the project started. But they did all right in the years immediately following the drought and the fires. Then a storm got a couple of nests after that, so we moved into stormier weather after the drought, and the kites didn't do so well in the last couple of years. The sea eagles, a similar story to the little eagles. They didn't do well in the drought, and when water bodies dried up, they basically didn't breed or even left. And since the water levels returned to more or less normal, they had a couple of good years. They've had, I think one year each pair had two young, but they mostly have one or two. But yeah, they've been doing well again since the drought.
So there's so much to do, and you did talk about volunteers. If people want to get involved in some of this bird research, and particularly the raptor research with LLS...
Yeah, to just get in touch with Local Land Services. Elliot Piccone is the officer looking after the raptor project. So, and Mick could possibly use volunteers in his project as well. So he's contactable through zoology at UNE.
So if one of the farm, for example, if a farmer saw a square-tailed kite or a white-bellied seagull nest on their property, they could just ring up the Local Land Service or send an email. Easy to find on the internet, Local Land Services.
Yep, Northern Tablelands.
Northern Tablelands. Elliot will look after them. Or Mick Wakefield at the UNE at zoology. Is the way through the Armidale Bird Watchers?
Oh, that's one way to get to know birds. Yeah, that's certainly one possibility. The bird watchers do meet, go on an outing to observe birds on the first Sunday of every month. We meet at 8 o'clock at the visitor centre. And as it happens, this Sunday, the next one that's happening is where there is a little eagle nest site at that location, which I will be interested to see whether it survived the snow or not. So we'll be including a visit to a known little eagle nest, or one that I knew of last year anyway.
Now let's go back to the Armidale bird watchers. Bird watching, obviously binoculars, walking shoes, maybe pack lunch and some water. So what was the regularity of the trips?
First Sunday of the month, 8 o'clock at the Armidale Visitors Centre. We're meet in the car park there. The coordinator of that outing program is Shirley Cook. But people can just turn up, introduce themselves. Mick's coming along on the next one we're having, because one of his nests there, or But yeah, people are welcome. Be good to see some new faces and especially some younger people.
Yes, well, I think birds, they're characters in our environment. That's what I like to think, whether it's the lorikeets on the blossom or whether it's even the magpie just collecting bugs or chortling in the morning with its other partners. Fantastic things, birds. And you're a wealth of information, Steve. I think we might tie it up there. Thanks for coming into Community Spotlight. It's been great to talk about your life with birds and particularly birds of prey. Wish you all the luck with keeping those species going and documenting for the LAS project and for all that you do with the Armidale Bird Watchers.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And you're a gem in our community, Steve, by the work you do for our birds of prey, and that is Community Spotlight.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM 92.1 FM in the car and at work for great tunes and community news.